Let's jump on the phone with our friend Marcus Berkman. The book is called Set Phasers to Stun. Hey, Marcus, good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it. I just got the book today on a PDF, and I've been reading it, and I got to confess. So, Marcus, you're born just a little bit before me. I was born in 71. So,
right.
So for me, I was 5 and a half when Star Wars came out.
Yes.
And so Star Wars has been a constant throughout my life, and I just never got into. I've watched you know, the old episodes, and I've watched some of the movies, but I'm not like a Trek guy. I'm not like, oh, I love Star Trek. I know it. I know of it, but and I know its cultural significance, but it's just never been my thing.
Yes.
And you kind of had the same thing growing up in England, where kids were either kind of Star Trek or really Doctor Who probably was much more popular, but you were either kind of Star Trek or Doctor Who, right?
Yes, I think you are now. I think it's very much gone in that way. I mean, and obviously some people are Star Wars as well. And then others have got all three, I suppose. That some people go for everything.
Yeah. Are you amazed by how popular Doctor Who is right now? And I don't know if it is over there, but over here in the States, Doctor Who is insanely popular right now.
Yes. Well, it's still huge here. And, I mean, in our usual self-deprecating British way, we think, oh, can this go on for very much longer? You know, it's gone on for 50 years or slightly more, I think. It's now, 52 years. And we wonder whether Doctor Who will survive another year or two and fretting it in our usual way. But I have a feeling that, well, certainly Doctor Who, possibly Star Trek, and maybe Star Wars as well, will all be here long after we're all dead.
Well, it very well seems like it. Well, with Doctor Who, and I've never watched Doctor Who, I have relatives who love that show, and I bought Doctor Who gifts for people, but I've never sat down and watched it. So explain to me, there's different Doctor Whos. As the years go on, they replace the Doctor, and then do they retell the same stories, or is it always new stories, and is it just, oh, this is now the new Doctor Who, or is it explain? Oh, I'm sorry. My newsman is freaking out that I don't know any of this, Marcus, so he's looking at me like, what is wrong with you that you don't know about Doctor Who? It just wasn't my thing.
I know.
I haven't had a chance yet. So explain to me, though, how Doctor Who works, and Roger, you can jump in too. Is it always like just we replace the actor, now this is Doctor Who, or do they explain how it changed from one person to the next?
They do both. So they change the Doctor Who when whichever Doctor wants to go off and do other things. And then they sort of reboot because it's quite a clever thing. I suppose Doctor Who invented the reboot before anybody else did because you start telling different stories. The thing about Doctor Who and the difference between that and the others is that Doctor Who is essentially circular. You always come round to the same things. It's nothing actually really changes. So you tell a big story, and then at some point the Daleks will come in, and at another point the entire universe will be threatened, and then eventually you come back to where you are. And in the same way that every episode of The Simpsons starts and ends in essentially the same place. Nothing actually really happens, and that's the secret of Doctor Who. Star Trek is different in that it's actually a story. It's a huge, great sort of meta story, just surging forwards over the decades. But Doctor Who that's the way Doctor Who was constructed. I mean, how they're doing it now, I'm not quite sure. But I think that's basically what they're doing.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about Star Trek. You cover the various series and some of the movies in the book, but the parts I'm in so far, and I think the bulk of the book, is about the original series, how it came to be and what it was, because it really was culturally significant in many ways. First off, it changed sci-fi on television, right? Nothing like this had been created, at least here in the U.S., up to that point, right?
That's fair enough, because before Star Trek, and Star Trek was the first, unless you count things things like the Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, which were just little playlets, but a proper actually running science fiction series hadn't really existed like that before. You had those Irwin Allen shows of our childhood, Lost in Space and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and Land of the Giants, which were you know, essentially children's series.
I
mean, they were shown at prime time, but they were basically for kids. And Star Trek was a much more grown-up series. It was a little morality play every week. Well, not all of them, but many of them were. And it was a much more serious show.
But you also write that one of the big differences between, say, Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, and maybe even Lost in Space, is the way Star Trek looked at things is the future was a good place,
yeah.
Not always fraught with, oh, my God, you know, the world is terrible. We have to escape it. It was going out and searching for better things and for good things with a more optimistic attitude, right?
That's absolutely right. Science fiction is a gloomy old genre. It tends to talk about the future as an appalling place where everything has gone terribly wrong. And Star Trek suggested, revolutionary in its way, that the future, actually, we were going to have sorted everything out, that, illness and disease and war and money and even television would have been abolished, and that, we would be living in some sort of earthly paradise and then going out and exploring the galaxy. And this was extraordinary. And in a way, it is still extraordinary because nothing else has quite like it has come up ever since, which is, I think, one of the reasons that Star Trek has survived is that it still has fundamentally that quite optimistic thought about the future.
When we think about Star Trek, do you think of it, it's so culturally significant in that it's had this staying power and it's still thought about, and all these other things were created after it. But I don't know, and I'd ask you, if we think about it in terms of quality, the way that we'll talk about, like I just brought up the TV show Lost, or a TV show Twin Peaks, or Mad Men, or The Sopranos, which kind of changed television in ways because of their quality or because of their innovative abilities. Is Star Trek the same thing? Because I think of Star Trek as a little more schlocky.
Well, possibly. But the thing is that when we're looking at the original series, we've got to look at it in the context of what else was on in 1967, 8, 9. It changed things in that respect. And then some of the later series, because, of course, when it came back as The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and Voyager and Enterprise, those series weren't networks. They were straight to syndication. And so they were slightly the secret you were there to do, you had to discover for yourself. And because science fiction has always been rather looked down on by sort of mainstream telly, they didn't get any, they were nominated for the odd Emmy Award, but they never got any. They were never really given any awards for anything. They were never really acknowledged. And yet, it's the influence of those shows has very much bled into the primetime television of today. I think something like Lost would not necessarily have happened without some of the Star Treks. You know what I mean? The sort of science fiction, as well as there being lots of science fiction actual shows on telly, it's also bled into the other genres as well. There's science fiction in everything now, and that's its main influence.
One of the innovations of Star Trek at the time was the blending of races, as well as strong women women in strong positions of leadership. Yeah. Whether or not they get a lot of airtime or not is different, but on the Starship Enterprise, there was a black woman who was, one of the leaders of the crew, and that was revolutionary at the time, I would assume.
It was totally revolutionary. And, there's a famous story of Whoopi Goldberg when she was a little girl going, rushing into the kitchen saying, "Mama, Mama, there's a black woman on the TV and she's not a maid." and then she took a part in The Next Generation as her way of saying thank you, because this was important to her, because Nichelle Nichols playing Uhura was, admittedly, she didn't have enough to do, and in the way of the 1960s, she was always wearing a very, very short skirt.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, she was in a position of responsibility, and this was a glorious thing, actually. If we think about it in retrospect, it is a glorious thing.
Roddenberry has, definitely sexual undertones in the shows, and women in really short skirts. Was he, how do we categorize him? Was that just, that's just the time we're in? Or even though there's all these great qualities about him, there was still a bit of sexism in the show. How do you look back on that and judge it?
Well, I think we all look back with a certain amount of, wry humor, because I think that's who he was. Whenever the costume designer of the time, he would present one of the female guest stars in some, relatively skimpy costume, Roddenberry would always say, "Shorter, Bill, shorter." because that's what he liked, and he was, as they would say, something of a ladies' man, professionally and in an amateur way as well. So that was his interest, and it's very interesting. It's remarkable how many stories, both in the original Star Trek and in the first couple of seasons of The Next Generation, when he was very hands-on there. There are lots of sex stories. There's lots of, whereas of course when other people take over the show, there's less of that. It's clearly a great interest of his.
Well, and you write in the book that even in the very first original pilot that was shot, he cast as one of the lead female characters a woman he was having an affair with.
Yes. And of course, she turned up then. She became later his wife. But that was Majel Barrett Roddenberry, she then became, who was number one in the pilot, the sort of Spock archetype, if you like. Spock took over that role. And then she turned up in the original series as Nurse Christine Chapel. So he always found a role for her. And then actually she turned up in The Next Generation in a guest role. I mean, she was terrific. No taking that away from her. And she was very much a keeper of the flame after he died. But nonetheless, yes, he made sure that there was room for his main squeeze.
Yeah, it's interesting reading about the original pilot and what happened. So the only cast member, so they shoot a pilot for NBC, and Roddenberry himself was an L.A. cop who wanted to write. He got into writing, wrote for a bunch of different shows, things like that, but knew that the real money was in producing your own show. Had several pilots that never made it past the pilot stage in the first shooting, but gets to this, gets it approved with some help from friends and some ideas from friends, because he'd never been a sci-fi guy.
No.
But pitched a show in one way that it was like basically like a Zeppelin that would fly to place on Earth, right, and discover new lands.
That was his original idea. He was going to set it at the end of the 19th century and have a dirigible flying around to places unexplored with a multiracial cast. I mean, you can see why that wasn't made, can't you? But nonetheless, it's only a jump or two, an imaginative
jump.
Yeah,
basically, they put it on a spaceship and said, how about now? And somebody said, oh. Okay, well, that's different, right?
Absolutely.
So they shoot the pilot, and NBC actually really likes it, but decide not to do it for various reasons. They recast just about everybody, except for Mr. Spock, played by Leonard Nimoy, although the NBC did want him replaced, and that character changed, right?
They did. They didn't like his pointy ears, and they didn't like his eyebrows. They didn't like the fact that he was green-skinned and therefore alien. And they were worried about the Bible Belt. They thought that people would think that he was in some way something to do with the devil. And they just this was the sales guys. They were the ones who worried. The sort of more creative guys were less worried. So there was a sort of argument with NBC about how this was going to happen. But Gene Roddenberry said, you know, no, I'm afraid Spock stays because he's a really good character. And obviously, as we know, he turned out possibly to be the crucial character.
Yeah, really. Shatner getting cast as the captain makes a big difference. The show is only on for 3 years, though. Why does it get canceled after 3 years? Are the ratings bad, or are there problems with Roddenberry? How does it go away so fast?
Well, there are lots of reasons for it, really. I suppose that the main one is that the ratings in the 60s were a very blunt instrument. It was just about delivering the numbers, and Star Trek never quite delivered the numbers. If you'd had a slightly more complicated, a more subtle way of measuring the ratings, they'd have noticed that this was attracting a young audience and predominantly an upmarket audience, the sort of audience that advertisers want to have. But the actual real solid numbers, it wasn't delivering. So, you know, ratings are much more sophisticated now, and Star Trek would now have survived. But I think there's also another reason, which is that we look at TV series now, and they've got producers, and they've got line producers, and they've got executive and supervising and consultant producers and co-executive producers. They've got huge teams of people working on this stuff, and some of them are actually producing the show, making sure it goes out, and the others are writers. They have lots and lots of writers on staff. Now, Star Trek had basically four people doing all of this, writing and producing it, and they were producing 25, 26, 28 episodes a year, and they burnt out. And, they used people up very quickly. It was a new show which had new ideas, and you needed to have the best people working on it. And the very best people who were working on the show in the first, say, couple of years left because they were burnt out. And the people who replaced them weren't quite so good. And the quality fell. And obviously, it's a much longer story than that. But the third season is pretty poor. And so you couldn't really defend it. If it wasn't getting the numbers on the pure numbers, it's also that the quality had gone down. And Leonard Nimoy himself said, you know, at the end of the third season, it was pretty much a relief to give up because we thought that the fourth season would have been even worse. Mm. And then we would have been back down into Irwin Allen territory. And then it's pretty likely the show would never have come back in the way that it did.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. It left people wanting more because it hadn't fallen quite that far. The book is called Set Phasers to Stun. Unfortunately, we're just out of time. I got to get to the news here in a minute. But Marcus Berkman, I'd love to have you back another time and get more into the story. It's fascinating.
My pleasure.